It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The Me Too movement has led many adults to share their experiences with sexual harassment and sexual assault. It's led to conversations and controversy, and we don't just hear about it on the news. We see it on social media and in popular culture. And even teenagers who are not interested in current events likely know something about Me Too. This hour, we're going to focus on the work of educators and parents to help prepare young people for safe and healthy relationships. We'll also talk about how to talk to kids about sexual harassment, sexual assault, and consent, and how preparing a child for a lifetime of healthy sexuality may begin long before puberty. We also want to hear from you this hour. Is the Me Too movement something you've talked about with your kids? Have you talked about sexual harassment or sexual assault? What have you done to prepare your children to have safe and healthy relationships in adulthood? We'd love to hear your thoughts, or in their teenage years as well. We'd love to hear your thoughts. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And throughout the hour, we're going to hear from a number of educators and a number of parents with varying experiences and varying perspectives. Again, we want to hear from you as well. To start off the hour, with me is Allison Oliver. She teaches human sexuality courses at the University of Iowa, but she also teaches children as well. She's facilitated programming for children from kindergarten through middle school with the Our Whole Lives program, which is a value-based secular curriculum. It's not taught in schools in Iowa, although it is taught in some schools various places in the country. Allison, thank you so much for being here with me.
Yeah, glad for having this conversation.
Well, and let's start with trying to put things in perspective a little bit. As a society, our understanding of when young people start to encounter situations where sexual education is useful, that has evolved over the years. I mean, there was a time not so long ago when it felt like you could wait until the teen years to have that conversation with your children about the birds and bees. But we really have changed as a culture, at least our understanding has changed as a culture. So from a perspective of an educator, from your experience, when do we need to start talking to kids about sexuality?
Birth is when we need to start talking with kids about sexuality. And some of that is really adapting our framework about what it means to be sexually active. And so from a developmentally appropriate perspective, I often ask my students, how many of you, this is on the first night of class, how many of you by a show of hands have been born? And they all raise their hands. I said, okay, then by the definition of this class, you are sexually active. And that means that your sexuality has been growing and evolving and getting informed and infused with all different kinds of messages about who you are and how you act in the world and how you feel about your body. And this is part of an educational experience that we have from the time we are born. And I think we do a real disservice to our communities and our children when we have this mythology of, I don't have to have this conversation yet. I've got time. And there are certain kinds of conversations that don't have to happen in the 0 to 5 age range. And it doesn't mean that there are no conversations to be had, because that education is already happening. So if you're not actually involved with it, then it just means that you're not a part of your child's sexuality education until much later.
Well, I can imagine people listening and feeling really uncomfortable, because obviously children who are ages 0 to 5 are not sexual creatures. They have not gone through puberty. We worry about over-sexualizing children early in their mm-hmm. lives. So I can imagine people thinking, wait a minute, let's not sexualize infants.
Absolutely.
So when you're talking about this kind of education for children who are preschool, what kinds of things are you talking about?
Mm-hmm. So for anyone who has children, they know that they are incredibly tactile creatures. They are seeking out the world with all of their senses, getting a sense of boundaries, of their agency, of expressing their desires. And these are all things that build the stepping stones for how we then later on interact with romantic and sexual partners. And so from an attachment theory perspective, it is offering those skills and parameters early, because they set a stage for what it means a little bit later. So developing a kind of comfort and knowledge with their bodies and boundaries around that and different types of intimacy, different kinds of skills involved in forming relationships and expressing what we want and how we might have to negotiate that when it's a good time, all of the things that inform their decision making, how they cope with disappointment. And those are all skills that eventually go into the kind of relational skills that we would expect people to have in healthy romantic and sexual relationships.
So active parenting that a lot of parents are doing anyway, but not necessarily thinking about it in this kind of context.
Yes. And I'm asking parents to think about it in this context.
Why is that important?
Because their children are getting messages about sex and sexuality. And for the most part, the messages that a lot of children get is that it's something not to be talked about, that it's inappropriate to talk about it, and that there's something wrong with talking about it. And so the messages that we get early and often, especially related to our genitals, I offer the game of, like, you know, in your 0 to 2 age range, body parts games are really common with kids. And so it's like, where's your eyes? And you have the kids point to their eyes. Where's your ears? There's your ears. Where's your knees? There's your knees. Where's your penis? Is not part of this game, right? And when they start developing the kind of language related to their to the body parts that have been deemed private, usually the message is like, don't talk about those. We don't say that in public. It's inappropriate. It's inappropriate to touch them. It's inappropriate to talk about them. And without any other kind of messaging that's taking place. And so it's like this whole part of their body just vanishes. And what research has found is that children who only receive messages about their privates being private and no other appropriate language for talking about their genitals, if they experience any kind of inappropriate sexual touch or sexual abuse, they are less likely to disclose that abuse to anyone else because the only messages they've received are, this is a part of the body we're not supposed to talk about. And they, a lot of children can't get past that discomfort of all of that messaging that says, I'm not supposed to be talking about this. There's something bad or wrong that happened that I let happen, that I did. And that, just from a basic prevention perspective, I think is incredibly important. That in contrast, children who have a healthy frame of reference for how to interact with their genitals, and it's normalized and they have some information and feel a sense of agency and autonomy and understanding of their bodies, are much more likely to be able to voice those and express those if anything inappropriate happens.
So you're talking about being able to name your body parts, not have names that obscure these body parts.
Yeah.
For example, but give me some more concrete examples. I mean, how do you normalize this? Because you also, we all live in a culture, in a society, we don't want to encourage our children to do things that other people might consider to be inappropriate.
Yes. And this is where I feel like it really needs to be community effort. And so when I talk to parents about using terminology like penis and vulva for their kids' genitals, they're like, I don't want my kid to be that kid that is bringing it up. And I said, okay, this is a community issue because we need all kids to be that kid. And it's language that things like toilet humor and things like that are totally developmentally appropriate. Anyone who has young children watches that develop, and it doesn't necessarily ever really go away among adults either. But being able to talk about like our bodies in terms of what feels good, how we take care of it, that there are different boundaries in different places at different times. We do that across lots of different conversations with our children about when is it appropriate to do this, when it's appropriate to do this, inside voices, outside voices. We're offering lots of kind of parameters for different kinds of behaviors, interactions, and speech. And this is just one other piece of that.
Another area that I know that you've explored is giving children agency over their bodies. We think about little kids, you know, 1-year-olds, 2-year-olds, 3-year-olds. Hug grandma, hug aunt so-and-so, hug mm-hmm. uncle so-and-so, give them a kiss. We instruct them. They don't have that kind of agency over their bodies. They don't necessarily get to make those decisions. And sometimes if they make a decision that makes us uncomfortable or hurts somebody's feelings, we'll push back. So mm-hmm. that's something you think we need to take a good hard look at as well.
Absolutely. I think that we need to model invitations as opposed to obligations. related to different kinds of touching, because those are built, those are building blocks that then get translated into other kinds of interpersonal relationships, where there are different power dynamics and things that create opportunities for coercion. And so being able to offer agency and model, if you're interested, you can give a hug to grandma. I think grandma would like a hug. You don't have to, but you, if it feels good, you can. And to pair it with those, as well as other kinds of invitations, like my child who just like fell down on the playground or on the playground with his bike yesterday. And I said, would some cuddling feel good right now? And so those are invitations. And it's with a sense of like, no is okay, yes is okay. And then being able to, you know, vary those, as well as modeling for myself when cuddles are okay for me and times when I just need you to get off my lap because I got other things to do.
So this isn't just about the parent-child relationship or the caregiver-child relationship. This is about the other people in your family and in your community as well. So how do you suggest dealing with that? Because grandma wants a hug.
Sure. And some of that is having the adults in children's lives also model disappointment. And I'll say, like, early on, my own parents struggled with this, that it's a reacclimation of managing expectations. And so when my mother would be like, oh, give me a hug, and my child was not in the mood, like, oh, what's wrong? What's wrong with, you know, it was like, what's wrong? What's the matter? Like, it's okay, you know? And I was like, not in the mood, and that's okay. And kept reminding folks about that. And now it's okay. And so we have a shared understanding of this is the way it goes. We also talk about how different people in different places have other expectations and how children can have agency over how they voice where their boundaries are with other people.
We're talking about talking to kids about safe and healthy relationships, about sexual education, about sexual harassment and sexual assault this hour. We'd love to hear your thoughts, your experiences. How have you been engaging with your kids on these subjects? Give us a call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. With me, Allison Oliver. She teaches human sexuality courses at the University of Iowa, and we will continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about having conversations with our children about safe and healthy relationships, about talking to them about sexual harassment, sexual assault, and consent, about preparing a child for a lifetime of healthy sexuality. And this hour, I'm talking with a number of different people who are involved in educating children, in parenting children, talking to them in different ways with different perspectives. We also want to hear your perspective this hour. We know that thoughts about this have evolved over time. Some people feel maybe they've evolved too far. We'd love to hear your thoughts. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm talking with Allison Oliver. She teaches human sexuality courses at the University of Iowa. She's also facilitated program for children from kindergarten through middle school with the Our Whole Lives program, which is a value-based secular curriculum, not taught in schools in Iowa at this time, although it is taught in some schools around the country. And Allison, before we take our next step here, I just want to ask you, you've worked with middle schoolers with this program since Me Too began, although not as it has gotten as big, I think, and visible as it is today. But I'm curious, did you have middle schoolers in your last year's program, did you have middle schoolers who were aware of the Me Too movement?
Interestingly, not very many. So of the 15, 16 students I had in that particular cohort of students, I think I had two who were familiar with it when we had our conversations about sexual assault and sexual abuse.
Okay.
So, and it was surprising that I was like, how did you avoid this? But it shows how siloed we can actually create our environment for our young people.
So. Absolutely. So in bringing up these conversations with middle schoolers, did you introduce the subject?
We did. I mean, we talk about current events in our curriculum and ways in which the media informs some different messages about it. And so some of the conversations that we had were about for those who did have some information about it was how common it was, based on all of the disclosures that were happening, and some questions about just how do we support our friends who might disclose to each other, since we know that people will generally disclose to peers more right. than other formal systems. So,
well, and we will talk more about that in just a few minutes. Again, Allison Oliver with me, but I want to bring somebody else into the conversation. Daniel Boskeljohn is a single father who lives in the Iowa City area. He has a 13-year-old child, Madeline, who identifies as queer and uses the pronouns they and them. Daniel, thank you so much for being here with me.
Thanks for having me on.
And you and Madeline are already navigating some difficult challenges for a 13-year-old. I think every 13-year-old has difficult challenges.
It's difficult to be 13.
Yes, absolutely. And already Madeline is obviously thinking about identity and about sexuality. So I'm curious, from your perspective as a dad, how has the Me Too movement changed your thinking or opened your eyes?
It was really revelatory for me. I had no idea how vastly cruel the world could be and how awful men could be, because there's just not the people that I hang out with or talk to, really. And it was really like when everything broke last year and I saw what had happened to my friends and how young people were and how pervasive it was, I just had no idea, because I don't go out a whole lot and I don't have those kinds of, you know, like I just, that wasn't part of my life at all. And women didn't talk to me like, oh, by the way, these things happened when I was 10 and 11 and 12. So I had no idea. And it really changed my approach to who I am and how I am and how I live and how I parent and how I teach. And it was a pretty big deal for me. It still is a pretty big deal for me.
So as the father of a 12 or 13-year-old, hearing these stories, what did that make you, how did that change your idea of what Madeline might be facing or thinking about at this age?
It did a lot. On the one hand, it was really clear that there was nothing I could actually do. Like, there's very little. I can't protect her. I can't save her from whatever will happen. I can't save her from being catcalled or stared at or leered at or groped or whatever. I can't do that. I can't be with her all the time. And the most that I could do is continue to do what her mom and I had started doing, which is just to try to create a sense of autonomy within her so that she always knew who she was and where, what kind of life was most appropriate and where she wanted to live or how. And so I can't protect from outside forces coming in, but I can do as much as possible to create a sense of autonomy within the house so that whenever I have conversations with my kiddo, I try to be as absolutely open and neutral and respectful as possible. And that's, I think, where it starts. And to have an open space where Madeline can share what happens on a day-to-day level and kind of go from there.
Was Madeline aware of the things that you were seeing with the Me Too movement?
I think so. I don't. It's one of those things, like, we're both on Facebook, and so I don't know how many of my posts Madeline actually reads, because they tend to be rather long-winded and tedious, and I think that kiddo gets kind of bored with that because Madeline
lives with
me already.
Parents are a little boring, right?
Yeah. So I think there's part of that. But, I mean, we did talk about it, and I did, you know, ask if anything had happened, and it was kind of a shrugged away question, and you tried to reaffirm, like, you know, you can always talk to me. There's no reason to be ashamed of what other people do to you or toward you or at you. That's not your shame. That's not your guilt. And just it tried to open a door that would be appropriate for a 12-year-old or, if, you know, and just right. kind of keep building that relationship in an open direction.
So in understanding our world and having a new understanding of our world that you feel you got from the Me Too movement. I mean, as a parent, we all want to protect our children from bad things happening. Do you feel like there's anything you can do to protect Madeline?
The best thing that I have tried to do is really open discourse about the logic of misogyny. I'm reading Down Girl right now. which is a fantastic book that really explores the philosophy behind misogyny. In every class that I teach and the public venues that I have, it's been something that's incredibly important to bring up and stay aware of and try to speak about in ways that show what's going on, how things are happening, and just try to take people from where they are. People who grew up in my generation, people who are older, people who are younger, don't always understand how pervasive the logic of misogyny is. And things that happen with Me Too are a particularly horrifying, intimate, and personal particular manifestation of that logic. But it's a logic that destroys men, it destroys women, it destroys those in between on the gender spectrum, it destroys relationships. It's really awful. And the more that I can do to commit myself to helping people articulate what it is that's being seen or what it is that isn't seen and draw attention to it, that's the only, I think, way to do something. As an educated white guy, there's not a ton that I can do, but that's a thing.
Now, I also have a 13-year-old, and it's a difficult time, but it's also kind of a magical time where they are starting to explore their sexuality and think about the world and find their identity in new ways. Have you, as a dad, in thinking about this, have you worried about scaring Madeline at this time when things are kind of exciting?
I mean, I don't know. Like, as a single dad, like, she's seen me date. She's seen me be in good relationships. She's seen me be in bad relationships. She's seen me be heartbroken. I've seen her be heartbroken. And so, I mean, the scariest thing is where somebody that you really love says, I can't be with you, and how to handle that graciously and how to understand what you can learn from it and what things you can't control. I mean, I've done a terrible job of showing her that in some ways, but in other ways, like, I'm doing my best to be very articulate about how that kind of works. And that's the scary thing. The other kinds of fears, again, you can't control. You can't control an outside act that imposes on you in a forceful way. But I mean, it's kind of an existentialist, like, I tend to go interior anyway. So
have you talked to other parent friends about this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Do you feel like it's something that a lot of your parent friends are thinking about at this moment?
I think so. But again, I come from a pretty, like, I choose my friends very, very carefully. And I have a fairly select and curated group of individuals that I'm willing to spend time with. And so that's a pretty limited segment. Yeah. So, I mean, my parent friends are totally on board and we have great conversations, but it's not indicative or representative of the larger culture.
Right. It's a small sample.
Yeah.
Well, Daniel, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and your experiences with us today.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Daniel Boskeljohn is a single father of a 13-year-old in the Iowa City area. This hour, we're talking about talking to our kids about sex, about safe and healthy relationships, and about what they may be hearing on the news or through social media spurred by the Me Too movement. We'd love to hear your thoughts and your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And we have with us Allison Oliver, who teaches human sexuality courses at the University of Iowa. She also teaches children courses about sexuality, about other social, I guess, challenges that we face as we grow through our whole lives program. And I also want to bring Carrie Trufunk into the conversation, Director of Operations and Special Projects with the Iowa Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Carrie, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Carrie, we've been talking about preparing kids for safe and healthy relationships and some basic sexual education. Of course, through your work with the Iowa Coalition Against Sexual Assault, you're often dealing with people who have experienced sexual harassment or specifically sexual assault. And I'm curious about the kinds of conversations that teenagers who are in situations like that need to be having from your perspective.
As Allison said, when it comes to talking with kids about sexual assault and bodily consent and their own sexuality, we need to start those conversations early. Unfortunately, though, so many people that are growing up in our society don't have access to good information early on, which then, if they unfortunately are experiencing sexual violence in their lives, increases the shame and guilt because there's not a lot of conversation about what do you do, how do you reach out for help. And what our society does a lot of times is push that guilt and shame back onto the victim of the crime rather than onto the person committing the act.
So much of the Me Too movement has been people disclosing stories of things mm-hmm. that happened to them when they were teenagers, things that happened and they did not feel like they had recourse. They didn't disclose to anybody. They didn't have a place to turn to for help. Have you felt like this is opening up the conversation, maybe giving some people more of an opportunity to reach out?
Yeah, one of the things that we've seen with the Me Too movement and how social media conversations are happening around sexual violence is that more survivors are feeling like there is a place for them to voice their experiences and feel supported. Because that's the thing about social media, right? We decide who we connect with and how we consume that information. And so for survivors that I've worked with and on my own personal social media, I see folks that are disclosing and are reaching out for help and are sharing information or talking with how they talk to their kids and to their friends and families about sexual violence, really getting some feedback that's helpful for them, that feels supportive for them. And so when we see things on the news that are positive or in our social media feeds that are supportive of survivors, that gives survivors a place to come and talk about that and really reach out for help and support. But on the flip side, as we've seen in the negative news cycle that happened for the last several weeks, around not necessarily the Me Too movement, but some other very public conversations about sexual violence. When that conversation shifts and victim blame happens in a larger context, that helps silence people and can make survivors feel really overwhelmed and triggered and like anything that they've done to that point isn't effective in the people around them. So I think it is helpful to have these conversations, to talk about Me Too, to talk about the realities of sexual violence. But until we really normalize having conversations about sexuality, both positive and negative, in a really holistic way, it's going to be hard for people that have had these experiences to really feel like the community is listening.
We have a number of people who want to join this conversation, and you are welcome to join the conversation as well at 866-780-9100. Leah is on the line in Solon. Hello, Leah.
Hi.
What would you like to talk about?
I just wanted to get into this conversation. I myself am a child safety advocate, and I have three kids of my own. I have been talking with my kids openly since birth. Using the popular terms for their genitalia, penis and vagina or vulva. And I found that when I have this conversation with other adults, friends, and when I do child sexual abuse prevention trainings, people are so scared of teaching their kids those words. But my kids have, like, it's just another word in their vocabulary. They don't giggle when they hear the words. It's not, you know, they always say, well, what if they say it to a teacher? Or, you know, we talk about elbows or knees or owies anyplace else. And I've, my kids are just comfortable, you know, talking about it now. And I, at first, getting into this style of parenting was a little nervous myself because we have conservative family members. But, you know, it's really opened the door for conversation with other adults in our family, too, about how we're raising our kids and being able to give our kids the autonomy and the vocabulary to express themselves.
Well, Leah, thank you so much for sharing that. That echoes a lot of what Allison was saying. And Carrie, I want to give you an opportunity as someone who works with people who are survivors of sexual assault. Do you see the power in that of being able to give things a proper name early in life?
Yeah, so many survivors that I've worked with personally have struggled with language around their own bodies, even as adults, even if the abuse took place 20 years ago. There's a lot of shame wrapped up in not talking about your body as a body and you having autonomy over it and the ability to consent to good touches or bad touches, and making sure that survivors have the language they need to express themselves is so important. And teaching kids that early puts that in place before anything bad could even possibly happen.
We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Carrie Trufunk is here, Director of Operations and Special Projects with the Iowa Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and Allison Oliver, who teaches human sexuality courses at the University of Iowa. We'll be back. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about talking to children about having healthy and safe romantic relationships, sexual relationships as they grow. So many conversations have been sparked by the Me Too movement, and it's given adults one more challenge in talking to their children about sexuality. And this hour, we're talking about how to have those conversations, getting some advice from educators and parents. With me, Allison Oliver. She teaches human sexuality courses at the University of Iowa. She's also facilitated programming for children from kindergarten through middle school with the Our Whole Lives program, which is a value-based secular curriculum. And also with me, Carrie Trufunk, Director of Operations and Special Projects with the Iowa Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And I want to bring somebody else into the conversation now. Marianne McLeod is the Director of Community Services for Bethany for Children and Families. It's a social services nonprofit serving the Quad City areas, and her work largely focuses on teen pregnancy prevention. She helps to provide an evidence-based curriculum in all intermediate schools in Davenport, as well as schools in North Scott and Bettendorf. Marianne, thank you for being here.
Well, you're welcome. Good morning.
And I understand that the curriculum that you work with in middle schools is probably a curriculum that a lot of us would be a little more familiar with based on experiences that we had growing up and going through sex ed when they were in school. And I'm curious, have you heard about or experienced the ideas that the Me Too movement have brought to the fore? Have you experienced it? Kids bringing that up in middle schools?
Oh, sure. One of the programs that we do, I have a co-facilitator, Patty Sorensen. We work together. We have 30 different groups from intermediate up through high school. But last week we were talking about values in our boys groups. We have like 8 boys groups. And they were talking about respecting women. And we asked them if they knew what the Me Too movement was. And they said, yes, they did. And they felt that it was very important that you did respect women, and so they were aware. We didn't know how aware they would be.
And awareness is one thing, knowing the name Me Too, as you got into the conversation, did they seem to understand it?
Oh, yes, they did. One boy shared a story that his mother was an advocate for women's rights and gay rights, and that they went to a parade. And then there were some negative comments made, and mom was a little reticent and wanted to go home. And he was very disturbed by that because he said, if you believe in something, you need to stand up for that.
Wow. Quite a young man there. We have a number of people who want to join this conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And, of course, we'll continue our conversation as well. But you are welcome to join us. 866-780-9100. Megan is on the line in Ames. Hi, Megan.
Hi there.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
I just had a comment to share. I think it's so important, teaching young people to have a healthy concept of sexuality and to teach them how to have that dialogue with themselves before they even really need it with anybody else. And I just see it as such a basic kind of health initiative where we know how to take care of our cardiovascular system. We know, how to eat well, but I just see it as another one of those core elements of being a healthy human being, spiritually, physically, mental health, sexually. I think that's a major one as well, and I'm so happy to hear that there are programs and initiatives out there to teach our young people how to have those conversations.
Well, Megan, thank you so much for your comments. And we were talking earlier about how as a culture, we have evolved. More parents feel comfortable talking to their kids about this, but there are still parents who don't feel comfortable talking to their kids about sex. And I've asked already, I've asked Allison to give me her perspective on how things have evolved. And Marianne, you've been involved in this work for a long time. I'm curious, do you feel like families are having these conversations more now than when you started with this kind of education, 25, 30 years ago?
33 years ago.
33 years ago. All right. So how do you see the evolution of these conversations?
I would say it's getting better, but they're almost forced to, given social media and all the things that we see on TV and all the things that have come to the forefront. But there are still parents that are reticent and don't want to talk about it, and definitely don't want to call the body parts what they are. What we see in both the younger students and the high school students is they really don't know how their body works, even if they're juniors and seniors.
They've gone through these programs in junior high.
Right. They need it about seven times. That's what they do. They need it about seven times. Because sometimes they're astounded when we'll say something and they'll say, well, I didn't know that. And they might be 16 or 17. And, of course, for the younger ones, the 12-year-olds, there's a lot of giggling, and they didn't know that their body functioned like that.
Interesting.
And we do have a program for parents. It's called Know What to Say, and it's to teach them how to talk to their kids about sex and how to get over that initial embarrassment and, how to answer difficult questions and how you can do it together. And we talk about what types of things to include in it. The one thing I can say, we've always talked about consent, but in the last 5 years, we've really beefed that up because there's been so much and so many people not knowing what consent really was.
Right. So what do you teach your students about consent?
Well, we talk about, definitely we'll go over what the state law is. First, we have to ask them if they know what consent is, and oftentimes they don't. And so then we will talk about that and what the state law is, and then we will give them different scenarios. And we will ask them, do you feel consent was present? Do you feel it was rape? And that promotes truly interesting dialogue. We can give the same scenarios at 15 different schools, and they will come up with different answers and different reasons why they didn't think it was rape. The three scenarios that we use are all situations that it was rape.
Interesting. And with those conversations, with conversations about consent, of course, there has long been an emphasis on putting off sexual intercourse in these programs that are taught in, especially in junior highs, and telling students that, they're educating them about contraceptives. That's a part of this evidence-based programming, but also encouraging them to say no. How do you feel that complicates this conversation about consent and the understanding of sexual assault?
Well, I think you have to do better than just telling them to say no. And that's, we have a program called Making Proud Choices, and we use it for 8th graders, 7th graders primarily. And it's abstinence, but it's also, we will talk about contraceptives, but the key to that program is that there are lessons in there that talk about refusal and negotiation skills. And I can say that every year at the end of programming, that's one of the things when the evaluations come back, kids say, thank you for teaching me that. I feel better about being able to say no. I didn't know how to do that. And sometimes as parents, we're very guilty about saying, you need to say no to sex, but we never teach them how.
Interesting. And Allison, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that as well. I know consent is a large part of the conversation that you have with middle schoolers in your education. You have that conversation a lot with your college students.
Yes.
As well. How does that interact with our understanding of sexual harassment and sexual assault?
Sure. And I think, and I appreciate Marianne's comment that I think we've done a better job in the evidence-based curriculum about building communication skills as it relates to refusal tactics and some things related to negotiation. Since a lot of the evidence-based programs are risk reduction for pregnancy, sexually transmitted infections, all of them are going to include, like, it's better to not engage in sexual behavior, which is why there's more priority that tends to be centered on the refusal tactics. And I think what is as important, as well as not just about saying and hearing the different types of no, but also in teaching people how to say yes. And that in a lot of the conversations, like with my college students, as they reflect on their lives growing up, it's that they have a hard time being able to articulate their own desires, their own sense of pleasure, their own sense of sexual autonomy and agency and possibility. And so I wish we would start earlier in acknowledging the experience and validating the experience of pleasure, and that that can happen independent of another in so many different ways. And then when we have shared pleasure with other people, that we can be creative and flexible and not just have one goal in mind, one step-by-step process that's this is what real sex or good sex or whatever is going to be, that we can teach them to be much more flexible and creative in negotiating different kinds of experiences with people that that can be reducing their risk of negative consequences and possibly more within their comfort zone as they're building romantic and sexual relationship skills.
Carrie, I want to get your thoughts on this as well. In working with survivors of sexual assault, we know that often there is shame that goes along with that experience and the aftermath of that experience. We know that in a culture where often victims are blamed, victims often blame themselves as well. So when we're talking to young people about consent and when we're talking to them about sexual harassment and sexual assault, how do you think we need to have that conversation so that maybe the shame that so many of these victims experience is not as prevalent?
And there's a lot of emphasis put on to whether or not something was sexual assault culturally by the presence of a no, when in reality, consent is so much about the presence of a yes, a presence of a, I want to participate in this sexual activity with you. Changing the concept away from refusal of sex to really participating in sex with people that want to be there, that enthusiastic consent model, that affirmative consent model, can shift a lot in our idea of what sexual assault is and what consent to sexual activity is. And so a lot of healing is done with survivors around their own healthy sexuality, around whether or not they want to be sexually active and when they want to be sexually active, figuring out if it's them wanting to reconnect with their bodies in a very personal sort of way, or if they want to learn how to connect with a partner and have a positive sexual experience with another human being. And so consent really isn't the absence of a no. It's a yes, I want to do this. This is where my boundary is. This is what I think sounds good or healthy or pleasurable. And so I agree with Allison that when it comes to talking with our children and young adults about consent, it really has to start young with bodily autonomy, decision making, and that it's okay and it's healthy and it's good to want to have that positive interaction sexually with other people.
I want to get back to the phones. Sean is on the line in Spencer. Hi, Sean.
Hello.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, I think one of the other pieces that we need to include in this is the fact that, you know, young men are the perpetrators of most of this stuff. And so I think it would be great to have some sort of programs that you could set up to reinforce some peer pressure for young men to basically self-enforce good sexual behavior with young women.
Interesting.
I mean.
Right. So bystander education, is that what you're thinking about?
Yeah, and so basically when, you know, a young man does something which is inappropriate, there's going to be peer pressure put on him by other young men of his peer group that say, look, we aren't going to we don't want you to have this kind of behavior. And basically, instead of turning young men into the perpetrators, we can turn them into the ones that will protect others against this type of
Really interesting thought, Sean. Thank you so much for sharing that. And of course, not all sexual assault is perpetrated by boys and men, although the majority of sexual assault is, and victims are not always female. But I would love, Marianne, you were mentioning your conversations with young men. I mean, in our culture, there's often a lot of peer pressure on boys and men to always say yes, to always want to participate in something sexual, whether they actually really want to or not. I mean, what do you talk about with your boys?
That is so true. That is so true. I can say this. This year, we were pleasantly surprised at one of the first groups we went to. It was at the high school. And it was the very first day of group, and they disclosed a lot on the first day, but the great thing that they talked about was how you need to respect a woman. And if another group member said something that was not appropriate, one of the other members stood up and said, that's not okay. And the other thing that happened was when they did something positive or said something positive, because we were talking about a lot about values on that day, they reinforced each other and said that, that's great that you can do that. And we haven't always seen that in the past. One year we had a group that was exactly what you said, that it was, yes, go for it, I can get it. But I think they've been given some food for thought. We try to model that in class. Sometimes we have young men that we've had in groups before come in and talk about what their experience was like.
We're nearly out of time. We could spend an entire another hour, I think, at least, talking about these subjects. But as in the last minute that we have, I would love from both Allison and Marianne, I would love to hear some advice for you. If you are a parent or a caregiver and you have a hard time starting these conversations with your child, no matter how old they are, can you give me just one little nugget of advice for starting these conversations? Allison, I'll let you go first.
I guess one of the first things that I would say is what I do with parents is to increase your own comfort, like figure out where you're at first a little bit more and seek support. I think parents deserve as much support as our children do in navigating these conversations, and especially if they feel uncomfortable, like getting some tools from other parents and other organizations. So,
all right.
Parents need education too.
All right. And Marianne, one last advice.
I would agree with Allison said. I would agree with that. But the other thing is that to let your child know that you aren't comfortable, you are embarrassed, and it's okay for them to be embarrassed, and that you're going to work through this together. And if they ask you something that you don't know, say, we will find it out together. It's okay to do that because it's not something that we talk about every day. They have to know that they can come to you.
Marianne, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Marianne McLeod is the Director of Community Services for Bethany for Children and Families. Allison Oliver, thank you.
You're welcome.
Allison Oliver teaches human sexuality courses at the University of Iowa. And Carrie Trufunk, thank you.
Thank you.
Carrie Trufunk, Director of Operations and Special Projects with the Iowa Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.